Mark Caro, and welcome to episode 134 of Caro Pop, sponsored by Revolution Brewing. Our guest this week is one of the all-time soul greats, William Bell. And if you don't know his name, A, you should, and B, you know his music. A major talent throughout Stax Records history, Bell has written or co-written some of the greatest songs ever. His debut single, You Don't Miss Your Water, was one of the Memphis label's first hits.
But now you've left me. Oh, how I cry.
And it later was covered by Otis Redding on his classic Otis Blue album.
You don't miss your water.
And the Byrds on their also classic Sweetheart of the Rodeo album. It is one of six singles being inducted into the 2024 Grammy Hall of Fame this month. Private Number, Bell's 1968 duet with Judy Clay, was a top 10 hit in England. His 1968 ballad, I Forgot to Be Your Lover, became a top 10 hit in 1986 for Billy Idol under the title To Be a Lover. More recently, I Forgot to Be Your Lover was covered by Bruce Springsteen and the Black Keys. Springsteen also covered Bell's Any Other Way on his 2022 album, Only the Strong Survive. Bell's 1967 song, Every Day Will Be Like a Holiday, has become a holiday music staple and also has generated lots of covers.
Every day.
And I know you know this undeniable song that Bell and Booker T. Jones co-wrote for blues guitarist Albert King.
Born on a bad sign.
Bell has a great origin story for that one.
Been down since I began to call.
Bell's own origin story is compelling as well, with a rise to fame interrupted by an army stint that took him by surprise. He saw himself as a ballad singer and became a great songwriter, often working with Booker T. Jones on songs such as Everybody Loves a Winner and the should-have-been hit Eloise, Hang On In There. Bell tells how these collaborations worked. He also gets into his work and friendship with Otis Redding and how Redding's death, followed by Martin Luther King Jr.'s assassination, shook him, the Memphis music world, and beyond.
This is where I live.
Now 84, Bell continues to make music. His 2017 album, This Is Where I Live, won the Grammy Award for Best Americana Album. His latest album, One Day Closer to Home, came out just last year, and his voice sounds amazingly intact and strong.
Out here on this highway, standing in the rain.
And his writing is sharp and filled with humor as he sings about what he knows. The same is true when he speaks. He's got an amazing memory, an eye for detail, and warm perspective as he recalls an amazing career that has spanned more than 60 years. I was excited when William Bell agreed to speak with me, and when you hear this episode, you will understand why. Please enjoy this Caro Pop conversation with William Bell.
Last night I had a dream. And there were three of me. There was the man I was, the man I am, and the man I want to be.
You took the name Bell from your grandmother, Bell. That's what I read.
Right. Yeah. And of course, grew up in Memphis there, South Memphis, actually about six blocks from Stax.
So were you aware when Stax opened?
I was passing along Macklemore Avenue every day because my mom worked up the street there. They had a place called Merritt's Bakery. That's where my mom worked. So I'd go up to meet her sometimes, and we'd walk back past the old Capitol Theater. That's what it was called then.
Right.
And then Jim, when Jim bought it, he converted it into Stacks.
So what was the first time you wandered in there?
For Carla Thomas's Gee Whiz, Chips Moorman, who was a musician and
right.
a producer there in the early years, knew of my group, and we were pseudo friends. We'd see each other in different jamming locations and stuff. And he called me. They needed some, they had put some group singing backup behind Carla on that Gee Whiz thing, and they were in their language singing flat, off key. So he said, would you guys come over and do some backup work? Maybe, you know, if this'll work for you. And I said, yeah. So I brought the group over and we replaced that group, and we did the backup behind Gee Whiz for Carla Thomas. That was how I came to the attention, actually, of Stax and Jim.
So your group actually is the band on Gee Whiz, which is really the first of the hit singles for Stax.
Yes. And then they signed the group, and we did a couple of 45s as the Del Rios. That was the name of my group.
Right.
And then I went on after some of the guys were older than I, so they were drafted into the military, and that left me and Lewis Williams as a duo. And he wanted to start another group, so he started the Ovations, and I went out solo, and I went on tour with one summer with Old Man Phineas, the band leader for the Flamingo Room. I went on tour with him during the summer to make some money. And when I came back, I wrote Yodoma Shawada while I was on that summer on tour with him. And when I came back, I ran into Chips, and he said, you ready to record solo? And I'm going, I don't know. I plan to go to college or something in the fall, in the top of the semester. So he said, well, come on by and let's see what you got. So I did. And I came up with Yodoma Shawada, which I had written. And he loved it. Mrs. Axton loved it. But Jim thought it was like a little bit too gospel-y, like a church song. So, but they prevailed on him, and we did record it. I think Booker did the organ work, but Louis Steinberg actually was the bass player on it. Then they had...
I think I read that Howard Grimes was the drummer.
Yeah, I think as the drummer. Howard was the drummer.
Yeah.
And they had different musicians back then. And we did record it. And of course, I did the vocals and everything, the backup vocals. And Booker did the organ stuff on it. And they prevailed with Jim to put it out. And it came out, I believe, in. It was like, I think either November or December of that year in 61. But
yeah, that's what I saw.
Yeah, but it didn't become popular. Well, it played it a little bit during the Christmas holidays, but the Christmas music was prevalent. And but they started playing it in earnest and the next year in January. And next thing you know, there were calls coming from everywhere. The first city that it went number one in was New Orleans. And then Baton Rouge, Houston, Texas, and different other places came through. And rather than going into starting college, I wanted to make some money while I could. So I opted to go out on tour to make the money. And so I went out there and did that. And of course, I didn't. They had the draft back then. And since I didn't go to school, they didn't draft me right away. So I came into Stax and we cut Any Other Way. So, which was another record on the charts for them. And so I went on tour again, this time with one of those R&B groups that you had five or six artists on the bus and a band on another bus, and we all traveled all over the U.S. So we were up at the Apollo, and my mom called me when I got the draft notice. She said she caught up. 2 weeks, 2 weeks later, she caught up with me at the Apollo, and she said, "There's a letter here from the government for you." So she hadn't opened it. So I asked her to open it, and she did, and it was, of course, greetings. And I still had three or four more dates to play with the theater thing chain. So I told her, I said, "Well, after I get through with these dates, I will come home. I'll fly home and go to the draft board and see if I get a see if I can get a deferment."
Wow!
It took about another week before I got through with all of the other dates. We were in Baltimore, Washington, and different places playing dates, and I flew home, and I had just bought a brand new car, so I got him a new car, and I drove to the draft board downtown and walked in, and the desk sergeant, I told him who I was, and he looked on the books. He said, "Oh, you were supposed to be here 2 weeks ago, and you AWOL." I'm going, "AWOL?" He said, "No, step in the back room back here," and so I did. I went to the back room, and we had five or six other guys back there, and there was another sergeant back there, and not knowing what was going on, he said, "Everybody raise your right hand." And so we raised our hand, and we took the oath.
Oh, man.
So
you were in the Army at that point.
The funny thing was, I'm thinking I can still talk about deferment. And so I told him, I said, "Well, I need to go back and who should I talk to about getting some kind of deferment?" I said, "Because I've got all these other dates." I had about 6 months of traveling tour dates lined up. I said, "So if I can get a deferment, I can play these dates and then I'll come back." And I can't tell you what he said, but he said, "You're in the military. You belong to us now."
So, oh, man.
We went from there and hopped on the bus, went down to the VA hospital and took the shots and took all of this other stuff. And they put us on the bus. And the next morning, we wound up in Fort Polk, Louisiana. That quick.
That is called interrupting your career.
Yes, absolutely.
Because to go back to when you wrote You Don't Miss Your Water, how did you write in those days? Did you like write lyrics first? Did you come up with music? Did you sit at an instrument and do it? Like, how did that work?
I did. I had the idea. We had a day off, and I was in a hotel room in Manhattan there, and it was raining like crazy, and I was missing the girlfriend, missing home and stuff. So I had been on tour with the Phineas's band for about 2 months, and I was kind of homesick. So I wrote the lyrics down, and I had the melodic structure of the melody in my head as far as a rhythmic concept, and because it was kind of a 6/8, 3/4 length thing, and I got home, and when Chips asked me about coming by Stax, I sat down at the piano and just kind of put a melodic structure together on it chord-wise. So when I got there, I told him about it, and he took his guitar, and he was just an excellent musician, too. And we just came up with all of the stuff there, and he took my chord structure and just made the guitar parts work, and then called in the people to record it. He loved it, loved the idea. Yeah, it came to life, and we recorded it, and then they called in. They wanted to put some organ work on it, and Booker T and I knew each other. Our family went to the same church. And he was an organist part-time at the church and everything. So I got with him, and then they called him over, and he put some organ work on, and it just came to life. And of course, they loved it. Chips and Mrs. Axton and Jim didn't like it quite as much, but they prevailed. And
what did you think? What was it like to sort of have thought of this, you know, song? You're sitting in a hotel, you come up with one of these, you know, great phrases in all of music, where, you know, you don't miss your water till your well run dry, and you come up with this song, and then you hear it come to life in the studio. What was that like for you?
As a young kid, it was great. You know, you don't think monetarily or stuff like that, but just to have something that's going to be put on the radio, put on record, it was wonderful, you know. And we had recorded a couple of tunes with the Del Rios for Stax, and they were regional hits with the college circuit and all that. And so we traveled Arkansas, Mississippi, Tennessee, parts of Kentucky, working the college circuit for it. And then when they were drafted, a couple of the guys were drafted that just left me and Lewis. And so it was just wonderful, though, just to realize that I was going to have a record out. And I liked the song, but I didn't have any inkling that it would become that big. But it was one of Stax's first major, because when they did Gee Whiz, they put it on Atlantic. And this was one of Stax's first national hits. And when they started calling me from different cities about performing, it was just a wonderful feeling to know that I had something out there that people recognized. And when I went to these different cities, it was like the fans already knew me.
Wow. I think 69 was Sweetheart of the Rodeo, and the Byrds covered You Don't Miss Your Water for that.
Yeah. Because I came out of the military in 65, and Stax had my contract rate retroactive, and I still had 3 years to go on it because I signed a 5-year contract with them. And so then, of course, they tried different songs, different writers and stuff, but nothing actually worked. So I asked Jim if I could sit in, just because I spent most of my military in Hawaii. So all I had heard was for a year and a half was surfing music and stuff like that. Jan and Dean and people like that.
Really?
Yeah. And so I was out of touch from what was happening musically in the U.S. And you know, also I asked Jim, let me just, after I cut a couple of 45s and nothing with other writers were happening, so I said, let me just reorient myself into what's happening musically and let's see what I can come up with.
Were you writing music when you were in the military, and were you performing?
I didn't do a lot of writing. I was still performing. I formed a band, and we worked for a lot of the officers' clubs when we were on the weekend and stuff. And then the latter part of my career, about 4 months of it, I became assistant choral director for the Soldier Chorus, because my outfit, most of them were moving to going over to Vietnam, and that's during the Vietnamese conflict.
Right. No, I'm glad you got to stay in Hawaii.
Yeah. And we were one of the rescue squads and all that stuff. So I was with the 14th, and they went over, but I was short timer. And so they were, all of the Westmoreland, the generals and everything would come and have meetings in Honolulu there. So we were entertaining with my band. I had started a band. And then so they wanted me to be assistant choral director. So I did that for the last 4 months before I mustered out. And when I got back to Stax, of course, everybody was writing, but I was getting like the secondary songs. Everybody was, they had Otis Redding and they had Rufus and Carla, and everybody was superstars back then.
Yeah, I was going to say that Stax had changed a lot in that time that you were gone. I mean, the MGs had had Green Onions by then, and although maybe that was before you even left, but they were, they'd become bigger. They'd signed Otis. And
I was the lowest man on the totem pole at that time. And I realized, I said, well, I'm getting songs that they're writing actually for Sam and Dave and people like that, but they're not fitting me. So I'm going, and Jim was savvy enough, okay, I'll give you some time to glue your ears to the radio, see what's happening musically in the U.S. And Mrs. Axon had the record shop over there, so I would listen to the go over there sometime during the day and listen to all of the latest records that were being released and trying to see what musically was happening in the U.S. because it had changed quite a bit. And
what'd you think of all that music you were listening to?
I liked it, but it was like up-tempo. You had the James Browns and the Otis Reddings and the Lou Richards and all those people. And I was more of a balladeer. So, as a matter of fact, they say it's between, it's a toss-up. And I think You Don't Miss Your Water came out about 6 months before Tell It Like It Is. But those were the two songs that they were, it was a toss up who started the Southern Soul solid thing. And
that's interesting. I hadn't connected those songs, but that makes sense.
Yeah, it was between me and Aaron Neville, but I think mine came out, was released about 6 months prior to his. So I guess I won out on that. But both of them were the same kind of songs. And so I was a ballad singer. So my first song, I realized I'm getting the leftovers from all of these songs and writers that they're doing. So I wrote Everybody Loves a Winner.
Right.
And that was the first, that came out, I think, 66, 60, I think it was 66, latter, first part of 66 or 65, latter part of 65, something like that. But that was my first major national hit after I got out of the military. So, of course, I was back in the game again.
Right. Now, at that point, were you writing with Booker T?
Yeah. Jim had the idea of pairing off with lyricists, with musicians, that to maintain that we had good lyrical content as well as melodic structure. And then they were working the production people there that were signed to Stax, and Booker was signed as a producer. I was only signed as a writer and publisher. You know, they were publishing. East Memphis was publishing my stuff. And I was just as a artist. I was signed as an artist. So Booker was the producer on it. So we had a lot of success as a writer team there with Stax. So
how did you guys work? Would you be in the room together with him sitting at the keyboards, or would you sort of come up with something and then bring it to him, or vice versa?
Sometimes it worked both ways. Sometimes I would have an idea and I would call him, and he had a studio at his home in his den. So I would go over to his home, or we'd come to Stax and sit there a week on an afternoon that they didn't have a session or something, and we would create at Stax and put a demo down or something. And then once we felt good about what we had, we'd call in sessions, you know. But after a while, it was just like an assembly line at Stax. So we were there every day.
Right. Everyone was working.
Yeah, it was working good. That's why Jim knew that Booker and I worked good together, you know, because we had known each other, went to the same school and same church, and our families knew each other. So everybody was close-knit. Of course, Memphis is one of those cities where Al Jackson went to the same school, Booker and I. David went to another school, but he was from the same neighborhood that I was from.
Maurice David Porter?
Yes. So we were all from the same area there in Memphis, South Memphis. So it was just a small knit community of creators there that we all knew each other.
Did you tend to come up with the lyrics for those songs, or was that also collaborative?
Most of us lyrically, like Bad Sign, I had the lyrics and a bass line, because I could chord a little bit, structure on the piano, and play a little bit at Phineas Newborn Jr. would sit me down after rehearsals and teach me chord structure when I was working as a kid, 14 years old, down on.
Nice.
Yeah, and so I got a lot of those great jazz players were in the band, like Charles Lloyd, Hank Crawford, all out of Old Man Phineas's band. So I got the benefit of working with the Bowlegs, Millers, and the Honeymoon Garners, and all those guys during that time. And I was the kid at 14 working in a nightclub and loved it. They were hard on me, the older musicians. They were in their 20s. And they were hard on me, but they loved me to death, but they just wanted the best. And I got the benefit of all of it, because after rehearsals, if I didn't sing a chord right on a song, because we had to do both jazz and standard stuff as well as popular stuff of the day, they would sit me down at the piano, play the chord change. I had to learn it, practice it, go home, work on it. And when I come back the next week for rehearsal, I'd better know it. So, and they were hard on me, but I loved the learning process of all that. Yeah.
Nice.
So when Booker and I worked, sometimes he was actually the consummate, musician, because he played about six or seven instruments fluently. Because he came to Stax playing baritone sax on a lot of stuff. So he would grab a horn or a guitar. He played guitar on I Forgot to Be Your Lover, and people thought it was Steve Cropper. I said, no, that was Booker.
Right.
So he would have all of the arrangements. I had the melodic structure and most of the lyrics. Sometimes he would contribute to a line or something, but I was mostly the lyricist, and he was the consummate musician that arranged everything for us.
Were the songs that you guys wrote that turned out to be popular the ones you would have thought would be popular?
I didn't know at the time they would be popular. We knew that what we were coming up with were different. We knew that they were original pieces. We didn't try to copy anything or do anything like what we heard on the radio. We would just come up with something that we felt good about. And thank goodness we had great artists at Stax, you know, Albert King, I mean, born under a bad sign. I couldn't have found a better blues player for Bad Sign.
That's just such a fantastic record overall. I mean, that's one of those that just pops out of the speakers. I mean, the performance, the guitar, and the song. It's just like one of the, you know, tougher Stax singles that ever came out, and it's really fantastic.
Yeah, it became a staple of blues, and you know, after the Cream cut it. And it just went, as they say now, viral, and everybody was cutting it. I mean, everybody from Jimi Hendrix to Coco Taylor, Buddy Guy, you can go on and on and on. The American as well as the European musicians cut it.
Right.
It's like a standard blues song now, but we didn't know at the time it would become that. I knew that Albert loved it. He didn't like many things, but he loved me and Booker, because we take the time with him to teach him stuff. And when he was recording, because Albert didn't read, I don't know if you knew that, but I had to stand beside him and whisper the lyrical lines in his ear while he was singing it.
Mm.
And because we cut it, he only had a couple of days in the studio, so we went to Booker's house. I played it. I had a verse and a chorus and a bass line. And so I played that for Albert because Jim had asked if he didn't have enough tunes at the end of the session. And so Jim said, you got anything that Albert could do? And I was in the session and I said, well, I got this one song I was going to cut myself, but if you would play it for Albert and see if he'll do it. I only had that one verse, the chorus and the bass line. So I sat down with Booker and played the bass line on a keyboard for him, and he sat there and expounded on it and started putting the chord structure to it and stuff, and I started singing the melody. Albert loved it, but we had to go over to Booker's house because it was like about 3 or 4 in the afternoon, and they had some more. At that time, it was like a factory. They had some other artists coming in for sessions. So Albert was going to, he stayed over another day. We went to Booker's house, completed the song overnight, came in the next day and got with Albert. And he loved it because we had the full song and everything. And I had written that verse that I knew Albert would identify with. I can't read, didn't learn how to write. So I knew Albert would identify with that verse. So I wrote that verse as the second verse for him. And he just loved the song. And we got through it in a couple of passes. We had it, had the vocals down. And then he grabbed a guitar and put the extra guitar work on, and it just came to life.
Did you have any regrets that, you know, you didn't release it yourself first, or it sounds like it really came together when you got Albert involved in it?
Yeah, I was happy because we literally wanted everybody at Stax to have a hit record. So that's why I wrote stuff for Carla, for Thomas, for Rufus, for All in the Nightingales. I know I got a sure thing that was their first major hit. So I would write, and when I was not on tour, I would write for different artists, and I would always be at Stax because I wanted to learn the ins and outs of production, how you mic drums, how you do this. And I would worry Tom Dowd to death. He was such a patient man. I'd be up in the studio asking him, what does this fader do? How do you get that sound on this? And he was kind enough to show me. So, I loved all of that. So when he would bring in artists, he and Jerry Wexler would come to Stax with Wilson Pickett or somebody. I was always there. And I wanted to learn everything, all the behind the scenes, inner workings of the production.
A song like Eloise is one that I would have thought, when you hear Eloise now, you think, well, that's a hit, and it wasn't a hit. Did that surprise you that one wasn't? I mean, it's up-tempo and you're more of a ballad guy, but that's a really good up-tempo song.
It is. Eloise, Happy, all of those things, they said, well, we know you can sell a ballad, we know you can write, but you're doing a lot of live performances, and on my live performances, I was doing up-tempo stuff. And so I played the Mid-South Coliseum. You know, I was doing, when I'd come out, I would do cover tunes, up somebody else's up-tempo stuff. Sometimes it was Otis's stuff. And then they would say, why don't you ever record some of this stuff? I didn't consider myself that much of an up-tempo guy, but then Stax wanted me to have something up-tempo within a album structure. So that's what we did. We went in and deliberately tried to create up-tempo works that, and I was glad I did, because doing live performances, I had up-tempo stuff that I could perform other than doing a cover tune by somebody else.
Right. Yeah. The Soul of a Bell, which was your first album that came out in 67. Side one is all ballads. And then side two is starts off with Eloise, Hang On In There. And just, and then that's your like up-tempo side. And that was like, those are the songs that you're going to play live and balance out the ballads, I guess.
Right. And Stax was a, you know, they were that dynamic, hard-edged kind of label, you know, gospel church hallelujah kind of songs. And I was more of a hopeless romantic. All of the ballads, even though I was getting hits, but I wasn't getting those, the songs that's why when I first got out of the military, the first song that they gave me was I Thank You. It just, I think David and Isaac had written it. And it was a good song because when Sam and Dave did it, it worked for them. But I was one of these artists, when I sung it, I'm saying, nah, this is not me. This is not working for me. And so I would do the mediocre thing like Any Other Way and stuff like that. And I could do those kind of songs. And oddly enough, working at the clubs and everything, I would do Hank Ballard and the Midnighters and all of those things, which was totally up tempo, but I just didn't think that I sounded authentic doing up tempo stuff. But, you know, I did it just because Stax wanted me to have something up tempo. And, oh, yeah, that works for you. I said, okay, fine. Let's put it in the album.
When you did Do Right Woman, Do Right Man, which Dan Penn and Chips Moman had written, had the Aretha version already come out, or was that sort of around the same time? Because they're both 67.
Yeah, it was about the same time. See, I knew Dan, and I, of course, with Chips, he was my first producer. And Dan was a hell of a writer. I mean, he wrote just songs that would just melt your heart, you know. So I always loved his writing. And so when that song, they presented that song to me, I wanted to do it. I think Aretha released hers first, but I had already recorded it.
Interesting.
And so we put it in an album structure.
Pop is supported by Revolution Brewing, Illinois' largest independent brewery. Now that spring really has kicked in, Revolution's premium lager, Cold Time, truly hits the spot. It's an all-malt beer featuring Midwest two-row barley, Mexican lager yeast, a touch of German hops, and pure Great Lakes water. It's never pasteurized, and the brewed low and slow badge on the can attests to a slow, lower temperature fermentation that mellows the beer for a smoother, more flavorful sip. Cold Time is available in 12 packs of 12-ounce cans.
When I first went into the military, when I came home on furlough, I was at Stax when Otis came. He drove Johnny Jenkins in. Actually, he was just a driver.
Right.
And so he and I became friends because he wanted to get something to eat, and I knew about the four-way grill, which was a place that served soul food. So anyway, I took him to four-way and we ate some soul food and just talked. And he said something about he was being a drummer and that he drove Johnny in. So we went back to the studio and hung out for a while. So after I got a hit record, after coming out of the military, Otis was a big star then. You know, he had quite a few songs out. So they teamed us up in concert. And so we rode in the same car. We became friends, hung out in Macon when we were off and stuff, and just went to different clubs and stuff and hung out with people. And because he was approachable and the same as me, and we liked to hang out with the fans and have a beer or something and just have fun with them. And so he was that kind of guy, and we became really good friends with his family and his brother, Roger, and all. So after his death, I was there actually at the whole the session that he did Dock of the Bay on. And I had a job in Chicago at the Regal Theater, but that Friday, it started snowing so hard in Chicago, and there was a blizzard on the East Coast. And my dates at the Regal were canceled. And because Otis was trying to tell me, come ride with me and we'll go, and I'll drop you off in Chicago and I'll go on to Wisconsin. So when my dates were canceled, when he left that Friday, of course, I didn't go. I stayed at home. And he had gotten the band, the Barcade. They were my house band. I had a club in Memphis called the Tiki Club. And one of my band leaders at Porter Junior High had told me about this little teenage group, musicians, and told me, you need to listen to these guys. They're really good. So I listened to them, and then I had to go to their parents and see if they could work in my club as my house band. So Otis, the first time he heard them was at the Tiki Club, which was my club. And so he started, once they met Otis, he wanted to take him on the road. So, of course, they took off, went on the road with him. So they went on the road that weekend with Otis. And when I was at the house that Sunday and I was watching television in the afternoon about 4 or 5, and I got a call from Milwaukee. There was a guy up there named O.C. Was a DJ, and he knew that Otis and I were good friends. And he called me at home and said, did you hear about Otis? And I'm thinking that he was going to tell me that he had had a great show or something like that. And I said, no, what, he had a packed house or something, you know? And he said, no, his plane just crashed. And I'm going, what? And he was at the radio station, but they had ticker tapes in those days. So I'm watching TV, and that nothing had come across the screen on the TV. And I told him, I said, don't kid like that. Let you know. He said, no, I'm it's coming across the ticker tape right now. And I said, no, and I just hung up from him. And I'm looking at the TV and nothing on the TV, and I'm going, well, Otis is a good swimmer, because I knew he had just started his home in Macon and built a big swimming pool and everything. I know he's a good swimmer, so he'll swim through this. And then all of a sudden, across the TV screen, it started running across the TV screen. They haven't found his body yet, but his plane had crashed. And they had found one of the survivors, which was Ben Cawley.
Right, from the Barcades.
Yeah. And I'm going, oh, no. And I'm thinking, well, I hope all these kids will make it. And so I started calling OC back in Milwaukee at the station. And he says, man, they haven't found anybody but Ben yet. And he was telling me all of this stuff, and I'm going, I was just, at that point, I was just blank. My mind just went blank. So I got in my car, and I started driving. I was headed to Stacks, and it was still light out. It was dark, getting dust dark, but it was still light out. And I started driving, and I can't tell you to this day where I went, but I was driving. I didn't get to Stax until like 7:30 or 7:45 that night. And I can't tell you stop signs, red lights, nothing. It was just my mind was blank because I kept thinking, well, he's a good swimmer. He'll make it. And when I pulled up in front of Stax, all the lights were on. And there were a couple of ladies there from clerical workers. They were crying because this is on a Sunday.
Right. So everyone had sort of come over to Stax, even though they wouldn't have been working then?
Well, they weren't working, but they were just manning the phones.
Yeah.
And I think Jim and Al, they were either in Vegas on a conference or something. And so they were manning the phone, but they were in tears and everything. They hadn't found Otis yet. And I'm going, man, it was just the worst time, the worst. And so after that, they did find him, I think, a day or two later. And he was still strapped to his seat and everything. And then I was talking with some of his family, with Roger, because, like I said, we had driven on these tours in the same car with his manager and all that. And just so many memories there, you know. And we'd hung out with the people in Macon and in Atlanta. And so it was just awful. So I that next week, that Monday and Tuesday, looked like everybody instantly was coming out with "We Miss You, Otis" songs, and "We Did This" and "We Did That." And I got with Booker and I said, I don't know what we can do, because we were both just numb at that point. And I said, I would like to write something about his life and just give it to his family. And that's what we actually did. We went over to Stax late at night, and I had written this poem, and we put it to music and sat there at the piano, worked it up, and recorded it. And I got with Don Nix, who had he was the acetate guy that he made all of the pressings up for, you know. I got with him. I said, I want you to make one of these and so I can give to Zelma, Otis's wife. And so I called her up and said, I'm going to send you something. And I said, this is just, and maybe it'll be something that will ease your burden or whatever it is. So I sent it, and by a special mail and everything, signed receipt and all that stuff requested, and sent her the acetate, the demo. And then Don Nix had made an extra copy and gave it to Miss Axton and Jim. I didn't know this. So they called me up at home and said, William, we want to put this out. And I said, no, I don't want it. I didn't want anybody to think I was trying to capitalize off my friend's death. I was doing it more therapeutic for me. I just wanted to write and get it off and record it and give it to his family. Then Jim started, he said, they were on me for about 2 weeks. Then I guess somebody called Zelma. She got it. She called me. And she said, you need to put this out. Because everybody had out, Otis is gone, we miss you, and all that. And I at the time, I told Roger and everybody, I said, I don't want anybody to think I'm trying to capitalize off his death. This is just something that historically you can have here for him, you know. So that's what I did. But they were on me like, and I had a record that was coming out They were on me. They wanted to put it out as a single. And I just was adamant about not putting it out. So finally, they were on me so hard, everybody, Jim and Booker and Mrs. Axton and people in the studio, some of the musicians and stuff. And I caved in. I said, well, I'll say what, if you put it out as a B-side.
Right. It was a B-side to Every Man Ought to Have a Woman.
Yeah. I said, I will agree to it. If you put it out as a B-side, because I don't want anybody thinking that I'm trying to capitalize off his death. So I agreed to do that. So they ran with the 45 and with that as a B-side. Ironically, when it got to the radio stations, all the DJs started playing Tribute to a King.
Of course, they flipped it over.
Yeah. And of course, one of my first dates about a month later was Macon, Georgia. And I was really apprehensive about playing Macon because there were so many memories of me and Otis, me and hanging out with the family and hanging out at these bars and joints and where they had pickled pig feet in the jars and pickles and all that stuff. And we would, like I said, set up the house with beers and everything. And we were just regular people around our fans and having fun. So I'm playing Macon at the auditorium. And me and my band, we go in. And they had a couple of other acts on. I can't remember who they were. But when I went on, I did my hour set. And I came off. And the crowd just was like in an uproar outside. And they said, you didn't do, and I'm backstage. I'm going, what's going on? You didn't do the song. Cause they had played that song. I didn't realize it. And Roger had told me that backstage, cause he came backstage and he said, you gotta go back and out and do that song. I said, what song? Tribute to a King. They had played it in Macon for like a month promoting this concert. And I didn't realize that. So I had to send my band back on stage to do an encore.
Right.
And I did Tribute to a King. And everybody, they were happy. They were in an uproar, standing up, cheering and all that, but I was about to leave the house. I leave backstage when I came off stage without doing it, and they wouldn't let me leave without doing it.
Well, you're in Otis's hometown, and it's a beautiful song, so it makes sense they would want to hear it. But you know, your reluctance to seem like you're trying to cash in was
Oh, I know.
That was a very noble sentiment of you, because it's tough because you guys actually were friends. Really? And one of the reasons it's one of the, you know, it's such a good song is because it does come from the heart, and you're not writing it just to make money or to cash in. And people recognize that when you hear the song, but you're still self-conscious about it.
Yeah, because everybody was coming with the Otis Redding song then. And like I said, Otis and I spent a lot of time together traveling on tour for about a year as a duo team, a two-act team, and riding up and down the highway and all that kind of stuff. And it just, actually, within my career, I think I've only done that song live on stage probably maybe 10 times. Because if somebody doesn't, if they don't request it, it's just like it brings back so many memories for me, and I just didn't want anybody. But it was a major song for me, and I just always felt really weird doing it on live.
Hmm. What did you take with you most from having toured with Otis and just spent so much time with him?
our friendship, number one, we were competitive on stage, and there were some cities we would go in. If I had, it's weird about touring, all the time the headliner is not doesn't have the, depending on the city, he might not have the number one record in the city at that time. And some cities we would go in, I would have the record that was number one, even though some of his records, he had more records out there than mine. And I always went on the first half of the show. And we would get backstage and laugh about, okay, this is your town, since you got the number one record here. And let's see whose head is going to be cut this time as far as performance-wise. And sometimes he would win, sometimes I would win, but we would always laugh about it. And, well, you got me today, or so, you know, yeah, you the baddest, and all that kind of stuff. So it was just it's a friendly rivalry that we did. And then after that, after the show, we would go out and visit places and for an after party, or just go have a drink at the bar in the hotel or something and just have fun. So and then the next day like I said, we rode in the same car for a long time. And we had a joke about that. They had these cars back in those days. They had the hump in the middle of the car with the running board and everything. So if we were riding in the back seat, there were like me and Alan Walden and Otis, and we'd do flip a coin to see who would ride the hump, because the hump was kind of in the middle of the seat, was kind of hard, and if you rode for 200 miles,
right,
on the hump, so on the both sides, it was softer. So we would always flip a coin, and we'd always laugh about it. Though, and a lot of times, most times I won, and they would always check my coin with two headed and stuff. Just crazy stuff for us to humor ourselves.
Did you learn things from watching him on stage as well?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And he would learn from me and I would learn from him. I mean, he was one of the dynamos on stage. He would never, from the time he hit the stage, sometimes the spotlight people, they had those spotlights then, and they would usually set them at the center of your stage. And Otis would come on to the center, but he would never stand still. He'd be over to the left, over to the right. And the spotlights were way in the back of the theater or the auditorium or something, and they're trying to follow you on stage because the lights would dim on stage. And Otis would, he would drive a spotlight guy crazy because the minute he find him, Otis is back on the other end of the stage. So he would just set the spotlight guy would set it in the center of the stage. And sometimes Otis would be walking back and forth. You'd see him pass the spotlight, and then he would disappear in the dark on the stage. But they had footlights and everything. They would always, the color lights, and they're up above the headlights and stuff. But it was just stuff like that. And I noticed that he never had a comb, but he had this big afro. And I'd come off stage and I'd be sitting in the dressing room in my robe drying off or something. And he'd knock on the door. Hey, you got a comb? And he'd never get a comb back. I'd hand him my comb or brush, you know, because he's getting ready to go on stage. His band is playing, his chaser and everything. You got a comb? You got a comb? And I'd give him a comb and he'd walk out, and I don't know, he would give it to somebody and he'd come off stage at the end of the concert. Where's my comb? Oh. He didn't know who he gave it to. So it's like, so I started bringing just dozens of combs.
You said it had to have your stash of Otis combs.
Yeah, I'd have a comb box there that with nothing but combs and brushes.
It's funny. So
stuff like that, yeah.
On Soul of a Bell, it describes you. It says, William Bell, a warm, sincere, pipe-smoking man. Were you a warm, sincere pipe smoking man?
I was, and I had special blends of tobacco made up with a variety of tobaccos. And they always said they could always find me in the backstage or in the auditorium or in the club, because that scent would be all over and it smelled like, because they had chocolatey and I mean, seriously. And I started Duck Dunn smoking a pipe. I started Al Jackson smoking a pipe, because I'd come in the studio and they'd open the door. I knew you were in here somewhere because I can smell your tobacco. But yeah, I smoked a pipe for about 20 years and I finally gave it up.
So no more pipe smoking for you?
No, I was doing later in my career, after I left Stax, I was doing an album for my label, and I got I started getting hoarse during the course of the sessions, and I had rented the studio for like a month to get the album done. So my money was ticking away, and I'd get hoarse and gargling and all of this. You know, I'm paying for this studio time with all the musicians and everything. So I'm saying, okay, let's stop smoking, see if that'll help. And I stopped smoking the pipe. I filled it up, laid it in the container of my car, and I stopped cold turkey. No kind of gums or nothing. I just quit, put it away, and I had 2 weeks to go. All of a sudden, after about 2 or 3 days, my throat totally cleared up. I could hit high notes. It was clear as a bell. And I didn't realize, because I didn't inhale the smoke, but it was still affecting my vocal cords. So I didn't realize that. So I went to a doctor to check my vocal cords, because I know Otis had some polyps and everything just before he did Dock of the Bay. And it took him about a month to get right, because he was kind of apprehensive about Dock of the Bay, because it was a different kind of song. But so I went to the doctor to let him check my throat. And when he checked it, he said, no, he said, it's probably the best thing that you did. Do you smoke? I said, no, I smoked a pipe. I said, but he said, that was it, that even though you're not inhaling, there's still some of it's getting down to your vocal cords. He said, that's why your vocal cords were tightening up and everything. So, and then I had that mixture of tobacco. So I realized then it's the pipe that got me hoarse like that. So I'm saying, let me stop smoking this pipe. And for about 3 months, I'd get into my car and I filled the pipe up. I had filled it up with fresh tobacco, clean it out, fill it up. I would automatically, without even thinking about it, reach for that pipe. And when I start to my mouth, I'm going, put it down. And I put it back in the tray of the thing in my car. And I wouldn't take it out, because I said, I'm stronger than this. I wasn't born with smoking, so I can quit. But I realized it took a minute for me to get used to it. And I did it cold turkey. And every time for about 3 months, I'd get into that car. The first thing I did was reach for that pipe, and I'd put it back, reach for it, put it back. Finally, I stopped reaching for it. So I knew I was cured then, but I haven't picked it up since.
Well, it seems like that was a good decision, because, I mean, you had an album out last year, One Day Closer to Home, and your voice sounds fantastic. I mean, this is like 2023, and you're still hitting these high notes, and you still sound like yourself, and I'm like, that's pretty good. So yeah, you're taking care of your voice somehow.
I've been fortunate. I have a studio, so I still write and demo songs for other artists and stuff like that. So I keep my chops up. Sometimes if I haven't performed live, like after COVID, you know, for a year I didn't perform, and and didn't do a lot of stuff in the studio because everybody was sheltering in place. So I realized then you have to work on these vocal cords and keep your chops up. So I even if I'm home or something in my man cave at home, I'll do vocal things and sit at the keyboard or something and just run the scales just to keep my chops up. So I've been fortunate. Yeah, my voice is still intact.
Well, yeah, no, you sound fantastic. And you just won a Grammy Hall of Fame award for You Don't Miss Your Water. That was just like in the last few weeks, I think.
Yeah, that's a week ago. At the Grammy Hall of Fame and inducted You Don't Miss Your Water into it. And I'm doing a thing in Detroit for the Rhythm and Blues Foundation. So that's, they called me about that. They wanted to do it last year, but I had prior commitments. And so they called me early enough this year. So getting my flowers while I'm still above ground, so that's good.
That's, and you won a Grammy Award for Best Americana album for This Is Where I Live, which came out in 2017. So
right,
so you're still collecting. Are there any of these awards that are the most meaningful for you?
I've gotten so many. I've gotten awards from the National Endowment people, and that's one of the highest awards in the arts that you can get. Of course, the Grammy is up there because when your peers endorse you and you're doing the same thing, but when you're endorsed by your peers and the organization that create all these great people, and you realize you're in the company of some really great heavyweights, just like the Grammy Hall of Fame Award. Do you know that they've got people in there from the 30s and 40s? And when you find out some of those old masters and that wrote these songs, the Hobie Carmichaels and all these people, you're in good company. And I don't take that lightly. I've been fortunate to have in my career a heck of a fan base in all genres of music, from R&B to soul to country to blues, pop, rock. I mean, my songs are covered by Billy Idol, Bruce Springsteen just covered. Actually, the Black Keys or something, I think, just covered.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. No. So, yeah, they have an album, Ohio Players, and they did I Forgot to Be Your Lover. Springsteen did I Forgot to Be Your Lover and Any Other Way on Only the Strong Survive.
Right.
So
I'm fortunate that other artists can relate to what I'm doing. And I love it when they see something in some of my bodies of work that they identify with. And that's very important to me that, you know, when you're doing something, you don't know who's listening or who's watching. But when your peers start accepting what you do, that means just as much as your fan base to me, because they are actually competing in the same field that you are. And like the National Endowment people, these are artists in every genre, from painters to you name it, all kinds of artists, from fiddlers to from every walk of life all across the world. And it's a world situation for the National Endowment thing. And that's an important award, as well as the Grammy thing, because these are my peers here in the music business. But those two awards are right at the top. And then, of course, I got the Americana Songwriters Award. And you think about all of the Willie Nelsons and the Jim Reeves and the Hank Williams and all these people that came. Chips Moman. I mean, this guy, heck of a writer. Luckenbach, Texas, all that stuff. Roger Miller. I mean, you can go on and on and on, even in the Taylor Swift and all those. people that write, and I've had a lot of my stuff cut back, country acts too, so, but people that write, and when they hear something that you create and they identify with it, and I've had different people come up, both fans and creative people. I could have written that song because that describes me. And I'm saying, well, I write about life. And that's what I do. I write and I try to write honestly about it. Even if I take a hypothetical situation, I try to write honestly about how I would react to this situation, not how I necessarily see somebody else, but how would this situation affect me? And that's what I try to do.
The first song on your latest album is "I Still Go to Parties," and the chorus goes, "I still go to parties, but I don't dance as much, and I just don't stay as long." Right. I think there are a lot of people who could relate to that, who are your age and my age, and maybe even a little younger.
Yeah, and that's me. You know, I still go out. You know, I still like my nightlife because I grew up in it from 14 years old on to now. So I still go, and I think I've been fortunate enough to have my mobility and my health and strength at my age that I'm still viable in an industry that I love. And so I feel very fortunate. But they are those songs that I write. That's me. I still go to parties, but I don't stay as long.
Not gonna drink as much.
Right. I don't drink as much.
Well, yeah. And then you have another song, "I Will Remember Tonight," which is basically, you know, there's a lot of stuff in this life that I've forgotten, but I won't forget you tonight.
Right. Right. Sometimes in traveling around, and I've been fortunate enough to do that, and you go to different communities and different countries, and even if they don't speak, like in Finland, we had over 100,000+ people there, wall-to-wall folk, but they reacted at the same intervals in my songs that they did stateside. So it's the message of the how you are portraying the message, they feel it as a feeling, because people are people the world over, the same frustrations and stuff like that, and they feel that feeling. It's a common denominator. And when I went down to sign autographs, I had to have an interpreter because they didn't speak English, but they reacted at the same intervals in songs. And I've had that both in Spain and a lot of different places that spoke very little English. I'm just happy that whatever I write, and like I listen, I love opera. I listen to it, and I don't understand a lot of Italia. I do. I call it. I have a in German and Italian and Spanish. I have what you call survival thing. I can ask if I'm tired, or in French, if I'm tired, I'm fatigué. You know,
you just know what to ask.
Yeah, if I'm hungry, tired, or whatever, I can let them know that. But I listen to opera a lot. Because to me, I listen, and I don't have to listen competitively. But I feel it. If I listen to something that they're doing, it's all emotional. I can feel the emotion, even if I don't understand the lyric. And that's the same thing that people do the world over.
Do you still feel competitive with music you hear now?
I do. Yeah, I'm hard on me, and I'm hard on as my band and the people. My band, I have to give them props. They've been with me probably for 25 years. I've had three people in there that are younger and newer, but most of the band have been with me. We're like family now. They've been through it with me. And that's a testament of how you treat people and give them respect. They give you respect and all of that. You know, we are family out on the road. That's my road family and stuff. So, and we've traveled the world over. They've been with me a lot of places. So I just know that if you treat people a certain way, they will respond to you a certain way. It's like if you smile in the mirror, you'll get a smile back.
True. So do you have dates coming up? Are you going to tour again?
Yes, I'm going to do some Take Me to the River tours. That's another thing. I just finished filming some more scenes for Take Me to the River. Are you familiar with it?
It's that series.
The movie that we deal with, we did, we're doing a trilogy. This is the trilogy. We did one, Take Me to the River, back in 2014, 15, 16 for the Stax and the Memphis Music. And then we did one later on for the New Orleans musicians and stuff. And so now we're doing one for how we have influenced the European musicians all over, you know, the nations and stuff. So, and we've done some concerts with some English too. I just did wrote a couple of songs and did a couple of things with Josh Stone. Love her voice, love her and everything went so smoothly. It was just, and we're planning on doing a short tour of Europe this year. We're releasing the trilogy. They're editing now on some of the footage. I'm going to do the Jazz Fest in New Orleans. I'm doing Memphis in May. So there were a few sporadic dates I'm doing. Yeah.
Well, I'll have to come check you out at some point, because it's been too long.
I know. I don't do a lot of one-nighters anymore because I'm 84 already.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. You're you're doing great.
But I feel good. And I've been, like I said, very fortunate. My health and strength and mobility and all of that stuff is still intact. My voice and my mind, that's above everything else. But I stay surrounded with musicians and stuff in the studio. I have to keep up with the different technologies. I went kicking and screaming into the digital domain. But hey, I have to Zoom and I have to do all of the other things. And creatively, if I got digital boards, I have to be able to speak the language to convey to a younger engineer what I'm trying to get, you know. So it keeps you into life. It keeps you abreast of life. So
it keeps you younger if you're still, you know, trying to, you know, do stuff and be creative.
And gives you a reason to get up in the morning.
That's fantastic. I'm gonna throw in just this last question. Do you have a favorite cover version of one of your songs?
For one of my songs,
or one that surprised you? Like, oh, I didn't think of my song that way.
Yeah, one that surprised me was The Three of Me on the thing I did with John Leventhal, and I won the Grammy for. The song was in nomination as well as the album, the album for Americana. And the album won, but the song we lost out to somebody else. But I that song, the popularity of it for the subject matter, and I would always preference doing that song and saying, you know, I don't have a problem mentally with things. The Three of Me, I'm not psychotic or anything, but when you're writing, people identify with, and everybody has a different personality sometime, you know.
Right.
And so That was a song that surprised me, though. It's like, but I always rely on "You Don't Miss Your Water," "Every Day Will Be Like a Holiday," because they've kind of made that a Christmas standard. Ironically, when I did it, it was not designed to be a Christmas song. Al Jackson, the drummer, had an idea. I want to put some bells on this thing and some chimes and all of this thing. And that gave it that Christmas feel. But I was writing it for any kind of holiday, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and he just had that Christmas sound to it with the bells and all of that stuff that he put on there. And it, every Christmas, I've had fans come up and say, "I know it's Christmas when I hear Every Day Will Be Like a Holiday." So, okay.
Right. It's general enough that you really can hear it any time of the year, but it sounds especially good around Christmas.
Yeah. And then they played it on a commercial during this past year. You know, Walgreens had it in a commercial, so with a wonderful scene behind it and everything. So I don't know if they're going to do that every year or not, but that that just kind of solidified it.
Did you ever have any idea that songs you were writing 50, 60 years ago would be getting played and talked about and, you know, everyone would know in, you know, 2024?
Not at all. We didn't even think of longevity. Back then when we were doing stuff, we just were thinking about, is it commercial enough to be played on the radio? Because we were all about the little girls and things. Will they scream on this particular thing? So, hey, we had no idea. We didn't know that. We knew that there were two record labels at that time when Stax was coming up. That was Stax and Motown. And we were in competition. And usually the Motown acts were more polished with the songs and everything, because that's what they wanted to appeal to, a broader pop market. But most of the acts out of Motown were from the South. And so the Temptations and all these people and Gladys and all, Gladys was from Atlanta here. So most of those acts were from the South and migrated up to Detroit. And, there were a lot of competition between Stax and Motown. Matter of fact, when we did Private Number, Jerry Wexler told Jim, because I wrote this song for Judy Clay, and I didn't know they were going to make a duet out of it. But Judy had to go back to New York, and so she said, "Well, would you demo it and send it to me?" So I demoed the whole song and sent it up. We sent it up to Jerry Wexler in New York and to put, you know, her, Judy on it. And Jerry had the idea, let's make this a duet. So he kept my first verse, a chorus, put Judy on. And interwove her with the fade on it, and it sounded great. And Jim was happy because they always wanted to compete with Marvin and Tammy. So, but it was just weird stuff that was happening, you know. So that gave us, and that was the first big major pop record for Stax, was Private Number.
So when you recorded your vocal for Private Number, you didn't realize it was a duet.
No, I didn't realize they were going to use my vocal at all. I just demoed it for Judy to hear the melodic structure and the lyric structure of it. Phrasing.
That's funny. See, and it turned out to be one of these classic duets that has lived on. See, you never know.
Yeah, strangest stuff has happened. So.
Well, Well, thank you so much. This has been just a total pleasure and honor to talk to you. I've enjoyed your music for so long, and to have you be able to give all these, memories of it is really fantastic. So,
well, thank you for having me, and thanks for keeping the music alive too, because, like I said, we didn't have any inkling that 60, 70 years from now, this music would still be in vogue or even be played, and that's like three generations away. But it is, and it's still being cut by other artists and stuff. So we are just happy that that's happening for us. And actually, I'm glad that the labels like Concord, Stax, they are behind that, because it's good for not only the Stax Academy and all of that, the Stax Museum, and for the up and coming kids that are still coming along and learning a craft and something that will keep them out of harm's way, keep them from gang banging. And because that was God sent for us when Jim and Estelle open up Stax in a predominantly black neighborhood and said, and this was unheard of back in the late 50s, early 60s. Trust me.
Right. Especially with Dr. King. Did that change the atmosphere around Stax and, what you were doing afterwards?
It did. It really did. That was the beginning of the demise, I think, of the music thing, because for a couple of years it just died. And then, of course, then they got into a monetary situation with CBS and the banks and all of that stuff that happened. And it was really, after Dr. King passed, it was just really traumatic for everybody, black and white, because we had to walk in, as long as we had been there at Stax on that corner and within the neighborhood and everything, I mean, people would walk by from the gangs and stuff like that. And sometimes we'd give them money to go to the little liquor stores and stuff like that. I will say this, they had enough reverence for Stax after Dr. King was killed, and when most blacks were just frustrated, and we were predominantly in an all black neighborhood. They had enough reverence for Stax. Just about every building within, say, a mile radius was torched, except Stax. They left us on scale. But then when we got ready to walk out of the door with Steve and Duck and a few of the Wayne and a few of the white musicians and everything, we had to walk them to the cars and tell the little guys, no, they're one of us. This is a family here. And so, you got to go through us to get to them. And they would back off, And even when we toured, we had to do the same thing. So we did a lot in Memphis after Dr. King was assassinated to change the outlook of Memphis as far as integration, because I had the first integrated club at the Tiki Club there. And I caught a lot of flack from downtown, the police department and all of that, and other club owners trying to plant drugs in the club and stuff like that. But they knew me enough around Memphis, because I'd been working downtown off Beale Street there on Hernanda at the Flamingo Room since 14. So everybody knew me, including the police department. So I had enough voice to voice some stuff about all of the harassments and stuff like that that was going on. And after they embarrassed Jim, he had Jerry Wexler and a couple of his record guys there, promoters in town, and they were getting ready to go to lunch one day, and the police pulled up with guns drawn and everything and just embarrassed Jim So then he went downtown and threatened to put a picket line around City Hall, and they backed off. You know, they backed off. But we did a lot. Within the musical community, we didn't have that problem. I knew Elvis. I knew Dickie Lee. I knew Bill Browder and all these people. and then Jerry Lee Lewis. All these people, we would jam in the clubs and everything at night and go to the White Eagle and all that stuff and jam. The musical community was cool. It was the other demographics, downtown and everything, that had the problem with the integrated stuff.
Yeah.
And because I had the first club, and they would come through the door sometime with and just harass the people and harass me and everything, because I had black and white in there dancing, having a good time. And, you know, and until I started protesting and talking about picket lines and stuff. So it was, we had to really fight for acceptance in Memphis. And when Dr. King got killed, he was there for the garbage strike.
Right.
It was just a serious thing in Memphis. It was weird that we were there. We were one of the biggest money makers and putting Memphis on the map. But we were despised for doing it, not only by the constituents downtown, but by the banks and everything else. We only had one motel that we could use. And when Kimmons Wilson was doing getting monies and funds for the Holiday Inn, he came to Stacks, wanted to know if we wanted to invest in some Holiday Inn stock. And at the time, we would say, why would I invest into a motel or a hotel that I can't stay in? So because we could only stay in the Lorraine Motel.
Right.
From Cal.
Yeah, my understanding is that that was kind of your home base, you know, the home away from home for Stacks.
Sometimes we would rent out every room if we had a big show or something in, and band leaders and everything, or we were writing and two or three artists in, and they didn't have that many rooms at the time. Maybe they had about 30. So we'd rent every room for them. So we were doing that, and we would have it for 3 or 4 days, just having writer sessions and swimming, because they had a swimming pool, and we'd swim in the swimming pool. But you could not stay in any of the hotels there. And I was working on Hernando, which was like two blocks down the street, was the Peabody. But I couldn't stay at the Peabody. Or if I were coming in town to bring some friends, I couldn't set them up at the Peabody. So when they were asking about investing in something, that's what we didn't do, you know. But finally, it did. A lot of things started changing over in a few years, and it's still not the best situation, but it's getting there.
Did you all still go to the Lorraine after Dr. King was killed, or did that become just like too associated with that?
As a matter of fact, a good friend of mine that he used to be with Elvis. He and I, Jerry and I, were good friends. And he bought some of the property right across the street from the Lorraine, and some of the houses on Main Street there, not the one that James Earl Ray shot from, but some of the others. And I've got people that, you know, because they're building up Main Street on the south end now. And I've got people that in that area with homes, and they've created different homes and stuff out of some of those buildings stuff. And so it's like now it's a lot more lenient with the racial thing now. But still, there's a lot of crime and a lot of stuff going on in Memphis, as you well know, that needs to be addressed.
I remember hearing that, you know, the Stax musicians would sort of write songs in those rooms as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, a lot of Midnight Hour, Knock on Wood, a lot of great songs came out of some of those rooms. I went to school with the girl that parents owned it, and it was like a community that all the black people knew, that that motel and that area, and WLOK was on one block right down, a couple of blocks down. So that was part of our space where we were welcomed.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing all of that. It's just, you know, it's fascinating. And, you know, I'm really appreciate that you're able to recall all of that and again, share it. And also everything about your music and everything else. It's just been a total pleasure. I'm really happy I got to talk to you, and I'll have to talk to you again and see you and hear you sing again at some point soon too.
All right. Thank you. Thanks again for having me.
That's it for episode 134 of Carol Pop. Thanks so much to William Bell for writing and singing such great songs for more than 60 years and for being so gracious in talking about them. His song, You Don't Miss Your Water, will be honored at the Grammy Museum's inaugural Grammy Hall of Fame Gala and Concert on May 21st at the Novo Theater in Los Angeles. His most recent album, 2023's One Day Closer to Home, includes his new single, When I Stop Loving You. It's available on his own Will Be label to buy or to stream. Go to williambellmusic.com to learn more about it and the artist himself. Carol Pop is produced by Chris Wake, whom everybody loves because he's a winner. For a mere $24, you can become a Carol Pop friend and help keep this thing going. Please contribute at carolpop.com. Your support is much appreciated. I'm Mark Carroll. Please follow Carol Pop on Twitter, X, and Instagram at Carol Popcast. You could follow me as well at Mark Carroll at MarkCarro. Please share this episode, subscribe, tell your friends, and tune in again next week for another Carol Pop Conversation. Thanks.